Fletch heard Moxie walk along the upper corridor. She, or something like her, appeared at the top of the stairs. They were her legs between white shorts and white sneakers. The torso was hers in a light blue sport shirt. The head was wrapped in a red kerchief. The face was matted with rouge and powder. Bright red lipstick enlarged her mouth ridiculously. The eyes were covered by giant sunglasses in white plastic frames. Collar said, as if threatening, "Jerry, I'm not going to jump another stair."
"Oh, for goodness sake."
Moxie started down the stairs.
"Be careful," Fletch said.
She passed Collar and stood on the stair with Jerry. She ignored the knife. She took his erect penis in her hand and shook it as if she were shaking hands.
"You need something else to think about, boy."
"You called him boy," Collar said. "She called him boy."
"I should call him girl?" asked Moxie. "With his prick in my hand?"
Mrs. Lopez climbed the steps, reached around Jerry, and took the knife from his hand.
"My good knife," she said.
She started back to the kitchen.
"Get Mrs. Littleford, will you?"
Fletch asked Mrs. Lopez.
"They're all against me," Jerry confided to Moxie. "You should see what they're doing to me."
Moxie put her hands on his wet, shining shoulders.
"It's just the coke, honey. No one's doing anything to you. Everything's fine. You're fine. It's a nice day."
"It's not the coke. It's what they're doing to me."
"It's that little white powder you keep putting up your nose, sweetheart," Moxie said. "Drugs do funny things to your mind. Have you heard that?"
Jerry was studying Cy Collar's legs. They were unscratched. Stella came into the front hall. She had a bath towel in her hands. "Jerry needs an airing," Fletch said to her. "Why don't you walk him any direction from here until you come to water and throw him in? He needs a swim." Her eyes had heavy lids.
"You need a swim, too."
"I'm the one who needs the airing," Moxie said to Fletch. "Get me out of here."
"Dressed like that, you'll attract flies."
"No one will look at me," Moxie said.
"You're kidding."
On the stairs, Stella was wiping down Jerry's whole body with the towel. Looking at them, Fletch said, "Maybe a swim isn't a good idea."
"Who cares?"
Moxie took Fletch by the hand.
"Don't swim out too far," Fletch said to Stella and Jerry.
He pulled Moxie sideways a moment and looked into the living room. Edith Howell and Frederick Mooney were together on a Victorian love seat. She had a gin and tonic in hand. His drink was in a short brandy glass.
"Revivals," Mooney was opining, "are anti-progress. Been far too many of them lately. We must get ourselves out of the way and let the young people create anew."
"But Freddie," Edith said, "Time, gentlemen, Time was a great musical. It still is."
"Come on," Fletch tugged Moxie's hand. "We'll go see the sunset, out the back way, through the Lopez's yard." Chapter 17.
"So," Fletch said.
They were walking along Whitehead Street. Moxie's beautiful head made Fletch feel he was walking along with a gift-wrapped package on a stick.
"Jerry Littleford's mind runs to stabbing people with knives."
"That was nothing," Moxie said. "Forget about it."
"Your usual domestic incident? I thought things were getting rather serious there."
"You should never believe an actor," Moxie said. "It's not what's said that counts, it's the delivery."
"Including what you just said."
"I am lying," the liar said, Moxie said. "I wish he wouldn't use that stuff all the time."
"You mean you wish he would use it some of the time?"
"Sure. When he has an angry scene to play. He can become really frightening on the stuff."
"I saw that. But that's not acting, is it? I mean, it's just reacting to a drug."
"Acting is a drug, Fletcher. All art is. A distortion of perspective, a heightening of concentration. But when Jerry's just doing an ordinary hard scene, the stuff works against him, sets his timing off, makes him overreact."
"Do you use that stuff, Moxie? Like for an angry scene?"
"Course not. I'm a better actor than Jerry."
She looked across the street at the big sign on the brick wall.
"Wish I could go in there," she said. "I'd love to see Hemingway's bedroom. Also the room where he wrote. That was cute what we did when we were playing pool. You have a good enough memory to be an actor." Moxie, do you think there are different rules for creative people?
Sure.
There have to be special rules for being that alone. Something your father said this afternoon. Something about the obligations of talent being primary. We were talking about his relationship with you and your mother, I guess. He said, many men can love a woman and have a child, only a few can love the world and create miracles. Dear O.L., always the pretty turn of phrase. She walked in silence a moment. I guess he's right. How can there be different rules for different people? You just said it yourself, Fletch. I just said it. At the house, you just said I couldn't go out. It wouldn't be safe. I just said I wish I could tour Hemingway's house. I wish I would be 100% efficient as a creative person and 100% efficient as a business person. I wish I didn't have to have a Steve Peterman living many of the normal aspects of my life for me. She turned him sideways on the sidewalk. Look at me. I can't. He put his free hand over his eyes to shield himself from the sight of the kilograms of rouge, powder, lipstick, those foolish, huge sunglasses on her face. It's too horrible. I'm standing on a street in Key West, she said. A marvelous live-and-let-live town. But if you observe closely, I have to stand here observing different rules. There's been a murder. He walked forward again. Sure, she walked with him. If Jane Jones were involved in a murder, she could walk down the street without disguising herself as Miss Piggy. I can't. Crossing a side street, the sun was warm on his face. It's a question of energies, really, Moxie said. Where do creative energies come from? If one has them, how does one best use them? When they wear down, how does one refurbish them? It's a joyous problem. It's also a responsibility, you see, all by itself. An extra responsibility. I guess, as Freddie says, a primary responsibility. And one just can't be totally responsible for everything. Few chefs take out the garbage. The day just isn't that long. No one's energies are that great. Hand in hand, they walked through the long shadows of the palm trees on Whitehead Street. After a while, she dropped her hand. I know what your question is, she said in a low voice. Your question is, do different rules for creative people give them the right to commit murder? Don't cry, Fletch said. It'll make gullies in your face powder. I did not murder Steve Peterman, Moxie said. It's important that you believe me, Fletch. Fletch said, I know. Wow, Moxie said. What's all this about? Sunset. There were hundreds of people on the dock. Space to keep out of each other's sounds, there was a rock band, a country band, a string ensemble. There was a juggler juggling oranges and an acrobatic team bouncing each other into the air. There was a man dressed as Charlie Chaplin doing the funny walk through the crowd. There was an earnest young man preaching the word of the Lord and a more earnest young man in a brown shirt and swastika armband preaching racial discrimination, and a most earnest young man satirizing them both, exhorting the people to believe in canned peas. Each had an audience of listeners, watchers, cheerers, and jeerers. Across the water, the big red sun was dropping slowly to the Gulf of Mexico. The people milling around on the dock, ambling from group to group, looking at each other, listening to each other, taking pictures of each other, were of every sort extant. 100 miles of Florida Keys hang from continental USA like an udder, and to the southernmost point drip the cream and the milk and the scum of the whole continent. There are the artists, the writers, the musicians, young and old, the arrived, the arriving, and the never to arrive. There are numbers of single people of all ages, sometimes in groups, the searchers who sometimes find. There are the American families, with children and without, the professional and the working class, the retired and the honeymooners. There are the drug victims and the drug smugglers, the filthy, mind-blown, and the gold-bedecked, corrupt, corrupting despoilers of the human being. Wow, said Moxie. What a fashion show. The people there were dressed in tatters and tailor-made, suits and strings, rags and royal gems. You should talk, Fletch said, grinning into her huge plastic glasses. So many people for a sunset. Happens every night, even cloudy nights. What an event. Someone should sell tickets, really. Think what you have to do to get this many people into a theater. After touring the crowd, listening to the music, watching the performers, Fletch and Moxie found an empty place on the edge of the dock and sat down. Their legs dangled over the water. "What an outer reality," Moxie said. "Which reminds me," Fletch said, "simple enough question, who is the producer of Midsummer Night's Madness?"
"Steve Peterman."
"I thought you said he was executive producer or something."
"He is, sort of. There is another producer, Talcott Cross. I never met him. His job is finished for now. He worked at setting things up, casting, most of the location work, you know, hiring people."
"Where is he?"
"Los Angeles, I suppose. I think he lives in Hollywood Hills. Steve intended to be the line producer on this film. That is, stay with it during shooting and all that."
"So, which of them hired Jeff McKenzie and which hired Cy Collar?"
"Cross hired McKenzie, Peterman fired him."
"And Peterman hired Collar."
"Right."
"So Peterman is more powerful than Cross? I mean, one of the co-producers is more equal than the other?"
"Sure. Cross is more of an employee, hired to do the production stuff Steve didn't want to do or didn't have the time to do."
"Does Cross get a share of the profits?"
"I suppose so, but probably not as big a share as Steve would have gotten."
Down the dock, also sitting on the edge, a girl in cut-off jeans was staring at Moxie.
"What makes Steve Peterman as a producer more powerful than his co-producer, what's his name, Cross?"
"Talcott Cross."
"Everything in this business, Fletch, comes down to one word, the bank. Where the money comes from."
"Okay, that's my question. I thought a producer was someone who raises money for a film."
"A producer does an awful lot more than that."
The girl in cut-off blue jeans nudged the boy sitting next to her. She said something to him.
"But it was Steve Peterman who raised the money for this film."
"Yes, from Jumping Cow Productions Incorporated."
"What's that?"
"An independent film company, a company set up to invest in films. The world's full of them."
"Forgive me for never having heard of it. Has it made many films?"
"I don't think so. I think it has some others in pre-production. Most likely it has. I don't know, Fletch. It could be a bunch of dentists who have pooled their money to invest in movies. Jumping Cow Productions could be a subsidiary of International Telephone and Telegraph, for all I know."
Half the big red sun had sizzled into the gulf. A black, ancient-rigged sloop was sailing up the harbor toward them.
"Don't you care who's producing your film?"
Up the dock edge, Moxie was causing widening interest among the group of young people.
"I mean, if the source of the money is so all-fire important..."
Moxie sighed.
"Steve Peterman was producing this film."
The top of the sun bubbled on the horizon and was extinguished. In the harbor in front of the dock, the sloop Providence fired her cannon and ran down the stars and stripes prettily. And the people on the dock cheered. Evening in Key West had been declared. Fletch swung his feet onto the dock and stood up.
"Let's go home."
"But Fletch, after the sunset is better than before. That's when the clouds pick up their colors."
"There aren't any clouds."
She looked at the sky.
"You're right."
The young people down the dock had stood up too.
"Come on," Fletch said. "We can walk slowly. Look back."
Moxie got to her feet.
"You see the sunset in the ocean all the time anyway," he said.
The girl in cutoffs was facing Moxie.
"I know what you're trying to do," the girl said.
Her friends were all around her. Moxie said nothing. She stepped closer to Fletch and took his arm.
"You're trying to look like Moxie Mooney," the girl laughed.
Moxie said,
"Actually, I'm not."
The young people around the girl laughed. One said,
"Oh, yeah."
The girl said, "Moxie doesn't wear all that crap on her face."
"She doesn't?" Moxie asked.
"She's natural," the girl said. "She don't wear no makeup at all."
"You seen her?"
"Nah, but she's staying somewhere here in Key West."
"She's over on Stock Island," said the boy, "in seclusion."
"Yeah," said another boy, "she murdered somebody."
Moxie's arm flexed against Fletch.
"You really think Moxie Mooney killed somebody?" she asked.
"Why not?" shrugged a boy.
"What are you, a look-alike contest?" asked another girl.
"I want to see her," the girl in cutoff said. "I'm going to see her."
"Well," Fletch said. He tugged Moxie's arm.
"Good luck."
The girl in cutoffs called after Moxie.
"You look sort of like her."
"Thanks," Moxie called back.
Miserably, she said, "I guess." They were walking back on Whitehead Street. There was some color in the sky. "Anyway," Fletch said in a cheery tone, "I enjoyed talking with your father this afternoon." "You like him, don't you?"
"I admire him," Fletch said, "enormously."
"I guess he's a brilliant man," Moxie admitted.
"He's funny."
"After all these decades of acting," Moxie said, "he speaks as if every line were written for him. He says good morning, and you have to believe it's a good morning, as if nobody had ever said it before."
"How come he's all of a sudden so attentive to you?"
"He's not. He just landed on me. Can't find work, I guess. Nobody else wants him."
"Did he call you? Did he write you? Did he arrange to stay with you?"
"Of course not. He had taken up residence in my apartment in New York. I didn't even know it. When I went there a few weeks ago, you know, to talk to Steve Peterman, there he was at home in my apartment, his clothes and his bottles all over the place. He was nearly unconscious, looking at cartoons on the television. I had to put him to bed."
"Jesus," Fletch said. "Frederick Mooney looking at cartoons on television. All the bad satires of himself."
"I was pretty upset anyway, yelling into the phone, trying to find Steve."
"Had you given him a key to the apartment?"
"No, he'd never been there before."
"How did he get in?"
"The doorman gave him a key.
He is Frederick Mooney, after all."
"I heard someone else say that."
"I mean, everyone knows he's my father. I'd never told the doorman to keep him out. What else could they do, have a legendary genius raving in their lobby?"
"Different rules," said Fletch.
"This may seem strange to you, Moxie, put me down with those kids on the dock, but I'm proud and pleased to know your father. I find him damned interesting. I mean, for me to really see him and talk with him and know him, even though he keeps confusing me with a corpse."
"You're not a corpse, Fletcher."
Moxie stroked his arm.
"Not yet, anyway. Of course, if you get me to sign any more papers in the dark..."
"Think of all he's done."
"I had to bring him down here with me. What else could I do with him? Couldn't leave him sitting there in New York."
"So you packed him up and poured him onto the plane."
"He entertained everybody in the first class section. He had a few drinks, of course. There was a little girl about 12 years old sitting across the aisle from him. He started telling her the story of Pygmalion. He got everybody's attention by making all Eliza Doolittle's mouth noises. Began playing all the parts at once. Henry Higgins, the father. Then he began singing all the songs from My Fair Lady. People were standing in the aisles. 'Get me to the church, get me to the church, get me to the church on time.'" Moxie sawed out flat and guttural. "People crowded up from the coach section."
"Marvelous," Fletch said.
"It's nuts," she exclaimed.
"Yeah, nuts, but the little girl will never forget it. No one aboard will. Frederick Mooney doing Shaw at 30,000 feet.
"Nuts," she said. "Nuts, nuts, nuts."
"I think it's nice."
"Against safety regulations," Moxie said. "Have that many people in the aisles. Utterly nuts."
"The obligations of talent," Fletch said. "Different rules."
"He's a drunk," Moxie said easily. "He's a mad, raving drunk."
"But you love him."
"Hell," she said, "I love him about as much as I love Los Angeles. He's just very big on my landscape."
Chapter 18. Dinner at the Blue House was conch chowder, red snapper, and key lime pie. Mrs. Lopez provided the best Key West dining. Before dinner, Lopez told Fletch Global Cable News had called several times and would like him to return the call. Fletch thanked him and did not return the call. During dinner, Frederick Mooney said to Moxie, "But yet thou art my flesh, my blood, my daughter, or rather a disease that is in my flesh, which I must needs call mine."
"Oh, no," Moxie said. "More Lear."
Edith Howell said, "Freddy's a leering old man."
"And you, madam," said Frederick Mooney, "are a bag of wind."
And during dinner, Cy Collar said, "I knew something was going on between Dan Buckley and Steve Peterman. Buckley was not happy with Peterman."
He ran through his theory of the murder again, adding the idea this time that maybe Peterman had gotten Buckley into something illegal. Moxie said nothing. Stella Littleford, looking even smaller and more bedraggled than usual, said, "Marge Peterman."
As she spoke, she kept giving sad glances at her husband, who, after his swim, was still acting a little jumpy, and at first kept his smiles perfunctory and his conversation to the mannerly minimum. "Wives can get to the point," Stella said, "where divorce isn't adequate. How long had the Petermans been married? 10 years? And this was the first time I've ever seen Marge Peterman with her husband. I didn't even know there was a Marge Peterman. And all this time, Peterman's been running all over the world, going to bed with people, doing what he wanted." "I don't know," Fletch said. "Did Peterman jump in and out of bed with people, Moxie?" "Steve was interested in only one thing," Moxie said, performing fine surgery on her fish. "Money. And talk, 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 talk. About money." "A wife gets tired of getting shoved aside," Stella Littleford insisted. "Of everybody telling her she's not important. Of being told to do this, do that, do the other thing, and otherwise shut up and stay in the background. That could drive anybody to murder."
"Stella killed Peterman," giggled Jerry Littleford. "Out of respect for his wife."
Stella colored. "Okay," she said. "Why was Marge Peterman there? She'd never shown up before. There was no weekend planned or anything. Our work schedule gave Peterman no more time off than it gave us. We had weeks to go before a break."
"What you're saying, Stella," Fletch asked, "is that Marge Peterman showed up on location with the intention of killing her husband?"
"Sure."
"Does anybody know if she was expected?"
Fletch looked around at the faces at his table.
"I don't think she was," Cy Collar said. "When you're on location, directors, at least some of us, prefer not to have wives around."
He looked quickly at Jeffrey McKenzie and then away.
"Extraneous people."
He looked at Frederick Mooney, who was blinking drunkenly over his plate. His eyes settled on Stella Littleford.
"Have to be damn distracting. It's tough enough, you know, dealing with the emotions, the feelings of the people working on a film. When those people have wives around and husbands around to back them up, echo everything they say, lovers, retainers, and the odd relative."
Again, Collar glanced at Mooney.
"All telling them they're right, they're wrong, they're this, they're that. They look tired this morning."
Collar's voice went to a bitchy falsetto.
"And is that a pimple coming under your nose? And tell that Cy Collar that scene will never be right until he gives you a stronger exit line.
Makes it damn tough for a director."
Collar laughed at himself.
"Didn't mean to take advantage of a simple question and climb on my hobby horse."
"No," he said to Fletch. "I don't think Marge Peterman was expected. I think Peterman and I were of one mind on this topic. I bribed my own wife off with a trip to Belgium. I think if Steve knew his wife was coming, he could have asked her not to."
"And she would have stayed home in her closet," Stella said with disgust.
"Stroking her chinchilla," put in Edith Howell.
"Well, this time Marge Peterman didn't stay home," insisted Stella Littleford. "She showed up on location and stabbed the bastard."
Jerry snickered.
"Well, where was she during the taping of the Dan Buckley show?" Stella asked.
"With me," Fletch answered.
"And who the hell are you?"
"Nobody."
"He's our host," said Edith Howell. "Would somebody please pass the wine?" "And later," said Stella, "where was she? We found her over there behind those trailers."
"With me," Fletch said.
"Looked to me like she was hiding," said Stella.
"It's decided."
Jerry Littleford put down his knife and fork. "Stella killed Steve Peterman and thus struck another blow for the equality of women." Mooney's eyes kept closing and his head kept bobbing and he kept eating. He was napping during dinner.
"Investors," said Jeff McKenzie.
"Yeah," mocked Moxie. "Let's hear it from the investors."
McKenzie wrinkled his eyebrows at her. Apparently, like most taciturn men, when McKenzie spoke, he expected to be heard. He waited for attention and then spoke in a tone far friendlier than what he had to say to the people present.
"I've been thinking it out. Who had the most reason to kill Steve Peterman? He was really mucking this film up, he was. Here the company had hired a first-class director, me. I only took on the job with the understanding I could have a free hand with the script. I spent months going over that script. My wife and I flew halfway round this spinning earth. I spent a week in California thrashing the new script out with Talcott Cross. He approved everything I wanted to do. Of course, he's a professional, he is. I come out here to this American boot camp for heaven.
I think he means Florida, Fletch whispered to Moxie.
And here's this Peterman bloke rolling round on his back like a pig, turning everything on the menu into garbage.
Cy Collar's color was deepening.
You mean he fired you?
Right he did, said Mackenzie. And he hires a second-rate has-been director. Mackenzie jerked his thumb at his directorial table mate.
Who proceeds to film the original lousy script as if it was half good. As if it was any good. Excuse me for living, said Cy Collar. He was a deep crimson.
Come on, Jeff, said Edith Howell. Be fair. You were the victim of a terrible, terrible tragedy. Your wife was killed. You couldn't expect to carry on.
I'm not used to Yankee land, said Mackenzie. With a little luck, I never will be, I now think. But where I come from, down under, when something like that happens, a decent interval takes place. A chap's allowed to take the blow and recover.
Come on, Mackenzie, Jerry Littleford said. You were in no shape to direct after your wife's death. You still aren't. How could you be?
Mackenzie's eyes attacked Littleford.
I'll tell you, sonny, your best chance was to film my script, with me directing.
He made another disparaging gesture toward Collar. You haven't got a lawyer's chance in heaven doing things the way you're doing them.
Fletch was looking at Moxie. His eyes were repeating, having two directors in the house is like having two ladies wearing the same expensive dress.
What happened here? Mackenzie asked rhetorically, dropping his H's onto his plate.
The day after my wife was killed, there was no filming, of course. That same damn day, this failed director...
Again he jerked his thumb at Collar. Is flown in by Stephen Peterman, named the director of Midsummer Night's Madness. My script is thrown into the opera, and the day after that, you all start filming the original pile of garbage. He didn't even wait until after the funeral.
I know, Jeff, Moxie said. I spoke to Steve about that. I thought it was rotten. I tried to get him to hold off filming for a few days.
It wasn't respectful, for one thing, said Mackenzie. My wife was a lady who deserved a little respect, you know.
I'm sure she was, Edith Howell said quickly. I wish we had all known her.
But Steve said, continued Moxie, oh, you know what he said. He said how many thousands of dollars filming costs a day, how many thousands of dollars it costs to have the whole crew idle.
Idle, scoffed Mackenzie. Respect for the dead, I'd call it. A little respect for the bereaved.
Steve read me the figures, Moxie said. Said the investors would have every reason to raise hell if we closed down for a few days.
Exactly, Mackenzie said. Investors. Maybe your investors have got more sense than Peterman gave them credit for.
Maybe in the old days in Hollywood you could pull the line, investors don't want the movie good, they want it Thursday. But films cost a bit too much for that these days. From my experience with investors, they'd rather have a piece of something that has a chance of making a profit than a piece of something that stinks so bad it'll have to be buried in the sea.
Collar's face was going through the whole color spectrum.
Tell me, Mackenzie, he said, if you think Midsummer Night's Madness is basically such a lousy script, how come you agreed to direct it in the first place?
You don't expect me to be honest about that, do you?
Mackenzie said.
Collar raised and dropped his hands in despair.
Right now, I don't know what to expect.
It was my chance to direct in America, Jeffrey Mackenzie said.